This is June the 7th,
2000.
year 2000, tape 8. Okay. I discovered an ability to sell things on McDougal Street in sheer desperation.
Is that in New York? Or
in New York, New York, in Manhattan. McDougal Street, which is the center of all of these artists' homes and many of their activities. The first galleries you could get into would be coffee shops and along McDougal Street. And I mean, you can imagine putting up a totally non-objective work, you see, that time, at a time in the Metropolitan Museum, for instance, banned contemporary work, you see. Artists who accepted the influence of the German or the French Expressionists were welcome to that great museum. So I found myself involved in picket lines outside of the Metropolitan Museum, and picket lines again outside of City Hall when we had to put up with corrupt inspectors who came into the lofts and demanded that we do this and we do that, and would hint that if we gave them money they would go away. So these were this is all part of what we went through. There were people who were active in even vandalizing our paintings. People in defined schools that were faithful to the European tradition, like the German school led by Walter Stumpfig. How anyone can paint with a name like that. You know, General Stumpfig, I can see a General Stumpfig in the battlefield. But no, he would come to New York with his legions and vandalize paintings.
What do you mean by that? I mean, vandalize. Literally.
Yeah, slash them with razors or write obscenities on them, you see. Part of the survival were every now and again there would be cooperatives that would organize where painters would get together, and some of them would have money and some would not. They'd rent a cheap loft and exhibit paintings there, but these were always quarrelsome affairs which I managed to avoid. I really had a foot into the situation because I came from a foreign country. The artist club, their landlord was actually William Stanley Hayter, and I would sometimes go down there to get the rent. And I had the European artists like Chagall. I never met Chagall in New York. But Marcel Duchamp, certainly.
You met him?
Yeah, I met him, went into his home, and I'd like to, I'll talk about that, but I want to get, there were expatriates who did very much to enrich American art, and frankly, the greatest thing that ever happened to art in America was the GI Bill of Rights. GIs by the tens of thousands went through, visited the studios of Pablo Picasso in Paris, and they elected to study art. After this confrontation, because I complained about Picasso's attitude towards me when I visited his villa, you know, but still he was very generous to Americans who had liberated that country. Getting back to the war of survival, I found I had a talent for selling things. And that's apart from working during the day, invariably I'd be involved with the affairs at Pagano's gallery. It began as a little cooperative in this basement or boiler room of this building on McDougal Street, and invariably this coal boiler, yes, it was a coal boiler, imagine, would puff out smoke and soot, which, if you you know, works on paper, would suffer mightily, and would actually would be destroyed by this. But thank God, a guy who's working on his thesis was heat exchange, an engineer, decided that he would start a sandal shop in the village, and it was very successful, and he allowed us to remain because it was assisted his business.
That was Pagano.
That was Pagano, yeah. Mm-hmm. And anyway, every Friday night, the crowds would be unvarying. There would be people coming in to, you know, observe the high life, you know, in the, you know, the village, you know, look at crazy artists and listen to jazz. I was trying to think of a popular tourist spot, but I can't think of it. It was this jazz musician whose father was a society jazz musician.
Blue Note?
No, the Blue Note, no. The Blue Note, I'm glad you mentioned that. The Blue Note was not exactly recommended or de rigueur for the visiting tourist. It was a hole in the wall, and years later, when I left that scene, I remember revisiting it with my wife. She wanted to hear jazz, and Johnny Coltrane was playing, and Buddy Pettifer. And I knew these people. We all lived together on Thompson Street. They would have sessions in the basement, you know. And I knew all these people. I was their neighbor. These were neighbors having trouble paying rent, so they were more than neighbors. They were part of a strata of survivalists. And I remember going in there, and my wife went up to, I think, Johnny Pettifer, and she says, "I'm from Alaska," so this was really a big deal. And I'll never forget the utter weariness of this man. I thought, oh my God, the Blue Note is now ruined by its first tourist. But I want to say that on the floor that night, there was an audience of five people. One was a priest, an Episcopal priest who had been defrocked, but there he was in his collar, out of force of habit. A girl with a splendiferous kind of boa, feather boa, wearing a feather boa cape, and two other people who sort of looked at me sleepily. I think they're all high. And the young lady was, her name was Naomi. And she approached us and said, "Alfred, where have you been?" And I said, "I live in Alaska. This is my wife. I'm on my honeymoon." And she turned towards my wife and said, "Are you an Eskimo?" You see, but anyway, it was my visit out of context to the five spot. And of course, now it's become a splendiferous jazz joint. But
it was called the five spot then?
Or? The five spot, the Blue Note, uh-huh. And... but these were inextricably the same.
Okay.
Anyway, I thought of the old days when Thelonious Monk played at the Five Spot, played at the Blue Note, and then he had some gigs uptown. He's very proud of this, and he went with. It was always. Perilous for us, for economic reasons, to go uptown. But we found money to go and see Thelonious, and he would play, look at the audience, and turn his back to them, and sometimes not play. And I thought, well, this is a statement. We've come uptown, and this will teach us that statements are, you know, are the expense of the innocent sometimes. And we forgave him, but then we ran into him in the Big Eye. And the Cedar Tavern. I'm sorry, not the Big Eye. The Cedar Tavern was just like the Big Eye. But he came into the Cedar, and we decided to help him. We decided that around the corner was a little shop that had been selling groceries, you know, Italian groceries. And it was just a little hole in the wall. We suspect really that a godfather hung out there. That seemed to be their favorite place, to sit next to the zucchinis and vegetables. And we said to Thelonious, we said, this guy's moving out of here, and you can move in there. And all you need is get some musicians. We got people here. They'll set up a bar, you know. This is your place. We'll call it the Monks. They said, great. And anyway, we had a great first night.
Who are you referring to when you say we?
We would be the gang at the Big Eye.
The gang at the Cedar Tavern.
The gang at the Cedar Tavern. I'm sorry, folks. The gang at the Cedar Tavern. And the people who go to the Cedar Tavern, I want to say it was the most anonymous bar you would ever walk into. If you were in the village visiting the San Remo, it would be more like an artist's bar, you know, with people with wild hair and who would declaim poetry and get thrown out and then get ushered in. But the Big Eye was not like that. It looked like a place where, a successful building contractor would discuss the job with his superintendent or with his banker. And there were prints on the wall on the Cedar Tavern that were English hunting scenes, etchings by Stubbs and people like that. So these were high quality prints, but nevertheless, that was the decor. Other people remember other things about it. It was a great place. They had a kitchen in the back, and there was a sort of an Italian influence in the food you could get there, which is the only explanation I can make for the main dish being lima beans with some ham in there, yeah. And Larry Rivers, who of course was one of the Hoffman student habitués, what he remembers is the menu. And he did a painting of the menu. It's a collage of all the specials they had for all of 85 cents, you see, which was very, very reasonable, but not reasonable to us. It's like confronting someone with a steak and lobster dinner for $36. 85 cents was really unobtainable, you see. And there were soups you could get for 15 cents, and that was a hell of a deal. He remembers that, he should. But anyway, I'm not trying to avoid talking about one of the survival bars, Pagano's, but on Friday night, at long last, I'm going to tell you, there would be an invading army that would come down McDougal Street, following the well-trodden paths of tourists, and these were the cadets from West Point, you see, and looking for a souvenir of the village. And if I'd sell a painting, I'd head immediately for the Cedar Tavern, and this would be translated into beer and drink, you see. On a good night, I'd go back there with, I don't know why I remember $12. I remember $12, you see. And so that was a good night. And you could afford a round of drinks. And that is, the recipient would buy a drink and stuff like that. I looked at these young mavens, these young cadets, you know, and I thought, they wouldn't be interested in this. And I thought, yes, they would be. Because this, what we are doing, and particularly Franz Klein's calligraphy on telephone books, which were an entirely expendable thing for him. He wouldn't let them hang around the house. And I would specialize in running up on the street. We'd have to come out of the basement. And I sometimes imagined myself, because I'd stand on the step and look down the street like some sort of insect or cockroach. And then I'd see the West Point boys coming. And then I'd say, look at this. And they'd look at a Franz Klein typically. And they thought it was just impossible. I said, boys, for $2 or $3, wouldn't you want to buy this? So that you can get some measure of the madness that goes on here. And this is my accompanying act, you see. And invariably I'd sell 5 or 10 of these. That would be $20, you know. And sometimes it was negotiable. And I think of hundreds of works on in the telephone books by Franz Klein, you know, sometimes in black, invariably with the kind of electric blue. These first experiments with refracting yellow to balance the inner core of a painting that was out of balance. We used to call that space leaks. There was a whole nomenclature of expressions, intervals, which I thought belonged to music, but we ripped that off. Well, anyway, they were a huge source of income for us, and the years have gone by, half a century has gone by, and I feel like saying to the soldiers of America, you know, probably now generals, I said, boys, you remember those funny things you picked up in the village on a Friday night, you see, and you probably took them home and put them in a trunk in the barn. Well, they're worth $3, $4, $5, $10,000. I think it's my duty to talk to the soldiers of America and tell them that what they have is historic and of great value, you see. And certainly the Australians have bought the Cardinal for over $10 million. I don't know what it was. All this boggles the mind. Would love the preamble to this in the sketches, you know, this choreographic dance and then the attack. You see, they're worth tens of thousands of dollars. These things that were, they weren't exactly given away. It was great, you know. So that was a major gallery. We had a fellow there. I don't know whatever happened to Giuseppe Napoli, but we all know this was an Italian.
Did he run Pagano's?
No, Pagano ran Pagano's.
Okay.
And Napoli, Giuseppe, was a paisan of Pagano's, you see.
Okay.
And he did lovely little landscapes, but really the souvenir to take home to your folks, or to take back to the bunkhouse, or wherever the hell they slept, West Point. He would always overwhelm me with his little pot boilers, did Giuseppe Napoli. I wonder if he ever changed under this, you know, working within this context, you see. But then I think that he sold his paintings there and then wandered off down to San Remo, where, you know, the real artists, you see, would prevail. The village, I always felt perfectly safe there, though I was in the country. Legally, whenever I stepped out of the village, I felt unsafe. Did I have antennas? What about the time I rented a work room of Bobby Beecham, the painter Robert Beecham had, and this was on 8th Avenue towards 42nd Street, but this was directly across from a block-long building that was the immigration department, you see, and the inspectors would, these are the people who would swarm over the island, winding up on in that place where I first got a job, you know, at the Empire State Building. But then I lived across from it, and where were my antennas to warn me? They didn't exist. This was a more pervasive thing. The people that you would meet in the village, that you could earn a living in the village. I had a friendship with Charles Mongraviti, who was at odds with his father, as we all were. This was the head of the art department of Columbia, who, you know, I told you about him. And Chuck was wondering when I'd get through he was trained as an engineer, as a mechanical engineer. And you know, I had some training in that regard. And he wondered when I would get through with working on garments during the day. and when I could help him. And he says he's got a wonderful job, ideal job, and he was building orgone boxes for Wilhelm Reich.
Tell me that
story. Right. So I was involved in building orgone boxes.
Were you still in the garment trade?
Yes. At night, we'd call these things that looked like outhouses together. And then Chuck became interested in a renegade physicist who fled General Electric, I think. All these people flee General Electric who build the atom bomb. And this was a doctor, well, we don't have to go into his name, I think. Never mind his name. And he was working on a problem. He was refining potentiometers. Potentiometers in those days had the accuracy of say, a
bow. You told me this one too.
I did.
Yeah,
and,
I remember this potentiometer.
Yeah. So I became involved in that, doing some turning on the lathe, which they set up in this guy's bathroom, you know. And there are all these interests. Then there are underground theaters, you see. And then I met up with Madame F. Danielle. And Madame Danielle had a mission. She led a mission to America called, it was a cultural mission of the French Republic, bringing their art in of the theater to the American people. The title of the organization in America was the French National Theater. And they would put on productions in the village, but then they got a theater uptown called the Comedy Club Theater. And that was another revelation about New York. If people make tons of money and become millionaires, and this is old wealth, just what do they do? Are there an audience to all these things? Are the epicures, do they just taste everything? No, the comedy club was a club, a private club of millionaires who would act in different plays. And then they would lease the theater to you for $100 a day, which is very, very reasonable. This is off Broadway, of course, but physically it was near to Broadway, and everything about the theater was generously made and done, you know. Eva Danielle learned that I had some experience with sets, fabricating them. And she learned about this through a fellow named Pinero, who was not related in any way to the great Portuguese playwright. At least, I don't think so. And Pinero was acting in this group, and they were introducing plays like Ondine, Camévrier avec moi, and Ile de Chèvre. Come play with me would be the French for Camévrier avec moi. And Ile de Chèvre would be Island of Goats. And I did the sets for Island of Goats and for the Camévrier avec moi. I don't know who did Ondine. But
what do you mean by did the set?
Designed the sets for these productions, you see. However, the thing that I have for, you know, the beast, you know, how the female tames the beast, it really came from the sets of Comez-vous avec moi, you know, where clowns lead the horses and pretty ladies and stuff like this. There's a circus thing that I did that so many years ago, and it comes back to me fresh, you know, and I do something else upon that thing. Ile de Chèvre, I think that Ile de Chèvre, this production introduced Audrey Hepburn to the American people, but she had to speak French. Under the union law, the union said you do not have to unionize, but you must talk in the French tongue. Anyway, that introduced her, and the play went on Broadway. Of course, I was pissed that I didn't get any credit. I think the guy ripped off my idea for the set, you know, blah, 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 you know, loser. And then I did Ile de Chèvre, which is a fascinating plot, where there are three women. One is a virgin, and one is a young wife, and one is the mother. And this fellow has gone off to war, he has been killed in war, and then this stranger who knew him from the battlefield arrives to tell them about this fellow's tragic demise. And then he sort of insinuates himself and begins the seduction of these women. Finally, these women get together and say, Jesus, this son of a bitch has turned us against one another. He might be a complete liar. He may have killed our poor man. Let's get rid of him. But how? Well, this was a Sicilian farmhouse, and in Sicily, in the old country, they would have a hole in the middle of the kitchen, in the floor of the kitchen, and it would be a deep hole, or developed into a cellar, where you would find wine, where wine would be kept. Wine would be brewed in those big earthenware pots. And this was a two-act play, and in the end of the first act, this guy goes down to get wine from the cellar, and the women, after a hasty conversation about what he's putting them through, pull up the ladder and leave him down there. So during the final act, this poor bastard is begging the gals to send the goddamn ladder down, and they won't do it. And his cries become weaker and weaker. Anyway, I got a wonderful review that the sets were sober and invocative. This is with the French newspaper, I think it's Paris, Paris Soir, but in New York, you see. But I don't know, just a line, set sober and evocative. But the sets were, which I did at the, an amazing thing happened. An observer of this was Pinero's wife, who was an actress, very good actress. And during a rehearsal, the husband of the lead actress in Ile de Chèvre was, the fellow did nothing. He was a French citizen and seemed to amuse himself and others by climbing out on the fire escape and then appearing at the window by leaping and capering about. Well, during one of these odysseys which disrupted our rehearsals, he fell and got killed. Now, Miss Pinero, who doesn't speak French, memorized this in French and did the play. She was wonderful.
Memorized what?
She memorized Ile de Chèvre, which is in French.
Right.
And she was not French. Had no knowledge of French.
Why did she?
Because she was the only one around who had been to the rehearsals. She felt the rhythm of the thing, you see. And
I guess I'm a little lost as to how this relates to this man falling to his death.
The husband of the lead actress, the wife of the lead actress, was mortified by this and could not act. We had 5 days to go.
Okay.
5 days for this gal to
Mrs.
Pinero. Yeah.
Okay.
Meanwhile, at that time, at that juncture, I wanted to introduce a new idea that I had, but after this appalling incident, I didn't introduce it. It was my idea that actors should create their own environment. You know, never mind some guy coming along and, you know, taping something for them. I thought that they should bring to the first, you know, the second rehearsal, to the so-called taping, where they figure out movements and choreography or what have you, that they come to the theater with sticks and stones and things and furniture or fabric from their own homes, and so on and so forth. When I announced this the day before the rehearsal, there was no set, no sketches, but I said, if you studied this play, you see, so the only set I'm going to give you is the well where this guy goes down and the ladder. You will have to find everything else. So this is almost the screeching and the uproar that greeted this was actually surmounted what had happened when this guy plunged to his death. But they arrived on the day of the final rehearsals, and some of them just brought rubbish, and there was really a magical thing. There was a fellow who went by a newspaper building. They'd thrown out obsolete typing press type shelf. Yeah. And I got hold of these and put little things in them, you know, and they were a mystery. People didn't know what they were. It was just wonderful what these people brought forth. Well, someone who, there were people who congratulated Miss Pinero in French. It was explained to them that she's not French and does not understand the compliment. Would you kindly talk English? So this is unbelievable. Then there were congratulations from the reviewer of Paris Soir, and he was there, and he said, I have a friend, and Madame Danielle should write you a letter of recommendation. Maybe you can help Samuel Beckett, because he didn't realize the sheer chaos of how this came about, you see. But anyway, later on, when I was able to travel freely, I met Samuel Beckett with this letter of introduction.
Curious about in my picture of your life there in New York in this village and so forth, is that you've got a job, or you've got two jobs, or you're drinking. I mean, someplace. When did you paint? I mean, that may be something at some point you put in here as part of your life, a part of your life when you were painting, where you painted, the kind of studio you had, something like that, because it's something I don't have much of a picture of.
Yeah.
Were you painting a lot? Were you submitting paintings to galleries? Or were there just certain times you did that?
Yeah. It works like this. I dare say it's still the same. The only hope of ever getting into an uptown gallery was in the month of December. And this is when the galleries would mount Christmas shows. And a typical gallery would display 50, 60, or 70 paintings. The paintings would be 8.5 by 11. Just prior to that month, the galleries would be charitable towards any painter. If he would bring in 8.5 by 11, he could not exceed that. The members of their own stable would show the paintings that were successful. This would be large. And the odds of your being, you know, the reviewers would come in and look at the paintings of the stable people, but sometimes they'd stop and look at the smaller paintings, and that would be a great break for you. So that's your only chance of getting into an upscale gallery. Another way to exhibit were in the co-ops. There's a certain opportunism with respect to where we work. The choice palaces were the condemned buildings. This is where I met Robert De Niro, and he'd permit me to do work there.
So you'd live someplace else?
Yeah, live someplace else, yeah.
When would you work? At night or middle of the night, or when you were working?
I would work on weekends, I would work at night. It's as if there was no day and there was no night. It was, it's like summer here in Alaska. The sun, you see. I often wondered how in the name of hell did I ever, why I didn't realize I was living across from the immigration department. That have people who had my picture on a Rolodex and were looking for me, and who had raided my shows. Then the thought occurred to me that I wouldn't be there during the day. I would be there at night, you see.
Ray did your shows?
Yeah, he went to one show asking for me. And
which show, and about when was that, roughly?
This was at Pagano's. They came rolling into Pagano's.
And this would have been around what year?
This was in 50, 51. And at Rienzi, I was a founder of a coffee shop called Rienzi. There were 13 partners. And we would exhibit paintings there. The police came rolling into that place.
For you?
Yeah. And with people from the Department of Immigration. The problem was I would use my true name in paintings, you see, and yeah.
Uh-huh.
Always, you know.
And when you partnered a business, you use a false name.
Yes. The Rienzi was an interesting enterprise. It was once a noodle factory, and it went right through this building on McDougal Street, you see. So it was really, it had impressive space. And we all furnished it by visiting these antique auctions, and for about $500 we had these magnificent Florentine tables and chairs, and I remember there was an elephant foot with antique umbrellas in it and stuff like that. It was just a wonderful undertaking that came about over nothing. And a splendiferous coffee machine with Italian eagles and stuff like this. A huge edifice. It was terrifying. And this and then you can go in there and drink coffee. And actually, this was the first. This was in this nation. It was the first coffee shop, Italian coffee shop. That was run by Americans, because we, all of us, most of the people here, I can't think of their names, were students in Paris, and they loved the coffee shops. They loved, some of them must have gone to the Sorbonne, because they enjoyed Dumagot. They'd been there when they had a little money, and the other coffee shops around there. Then there were other people in, there were 13 partners in this affair. And they wanted a place where they thought they could drink coffee in peace. But there's no peace when you own a business in New York. You know, there's no peace. You have trouble with the cops. You have trouble with the mafia in equal measure. But that was the first. And, of course, we served espresso and lattes and that black coffee, you know, in those little teeny-weeny. Yeah. And we had a problem there, because this is in the middle of the block. San Remo was the corner tavern, but on the end of the block across the way was another tavern which no one ever went into, no tourists either, and it was the hangout of Genovese, who became a godfather, and the first of the godfathers to embrace narcotics, you see. So this involved him in a war with, and we accidentally and inadvertently became sort of involved with Mr. Genovese. Mr. Genovese harassed us and went to the police. They said, "You better make peace with that man," said the police.
What did he bother you about?
He would send these young kids over there to, they would annoy people or break windows, our windows. We put up lights, and that kind of inhibited them a bit. I went in there and confronted him, not knowing, you know, I didn't know what the mafia was, anything like that, you know.
You went into that.
Yeah, and I went into the tavern? Yeah, and in going into the tavern to bear the lion in his den, there was a bar, and the end of that bar was an alcove and a toilet. And over here all were tables and chairs, you know, with the accoutrements of the bar. And it seems that I went in there and went right into the alcove and told the man to stop messing with us. And this was a terrible mistake. It meant no respect. It meant that I'd passed...
Wait, not so close to your mouth.
Okay. It meant that I had bypassed his soldiers and a wise guy and a made man at the bar, sitting at the bar, and seemingly avoided these people because I had no respect, and then addressed Mr. Vito Genovese. Vito. Anyway. His soldiers, his wise guys, and made men, and you don't do that. I didn't know anything about this. So anyway, the other partners who knew something about this were horrified. They were boys who were born in Manhattan, or from the Bronx, or Queens, or Long Island, and they said, you better get out of town, you know. And then, nothing happened, the harassment stopped, and then Mr. Genovese said, I'd like to talk to one of you guys. Send that limey in here. Send him in here. I got a deal for you boys. So I remember telling this to Robert De Niro. I was staying at his place and painting. He had a show coming along. He had a show. he was a funny one, was De Niro. And he had all the requisite paintings, but he intrigued his dealer, I think it was Zabriskie Gallery, one of the few galleries that had the courage to show our work then, and they liked Bob's work. His work, when you first encounter it, there's a degree of difficulty in understanding it, you see. He's never achieved to painters, he's a painter's painter and a genius. To everyone else, he presents a tough road to hoe. Anyway, when Robert heard about this, swinging by to have a cup of coffee at Rienzi, they told him about Mr. Genovese, he started crying. You know, whenever I see his son acting these godfathers, these god-awful gangsters, you know, and these psychopathic killers, I think of his father crying and then going in there to beg this guy for my life, that was saying that he's a stranger, he doesn't understand, believe me, he risked all of this for me, did Robert De Niro. Anyway, so then he made an overture. He said, I'd like to talk to somebody, and I went over there with David Wallman, who was sort of the president of the business. That might not be his name, but I have this guy was a painter who now owns a coffee who owned the Rienzi and accepted the responsibility. You see, the others had classes and schedules and things. They thought, this isn't what we planned, you know, to deal with all these people. Anyway, so I went over there this time I told the people at the bar that I was in there to see the boss. And, you know, I walked this chorus line of the soldiers who took me on to the maid, who took me on to the wise guy, who then took me to the maid man at the end of the bar, who brought me before Mr. Genovese. So in other words, respect was shown to all of these people. And I was confronted by Mr. Genovese and another made man. Willie, you're sitting on the wire. Get up, you idiot. All right. Anyway, the deal, he said, I really like what you guys are doing, see? It's a great idea. And he said, I want you to do the same for me. Do you agree to do that? And I said, well, I think so. He said, yeah, we're going to have this place on Christopher Street, and I got a name for you, the Cabaret, and you do all the rest. And we said, well, there's the question of a liquor license. You know, we wanted to sell liquor at the Rienzi, and they said, forget about it. You need to bribe this guy and talk to that guy, and it would take a couple of years, you see. He said, you want a liquor license? When you open the joint, you'll have a liquor license. You hear me? I said, I understand, Mr. Genovese. So we had a liquor license. So we had a... So we would have an act in there, you see, and the thing would have acts, so people would entertain. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, this is really great. And then one night I was there with a young lady to inspect the new premises, you know, the new cabaret. And there was a fellow, the hell was it? This is some existential poet. The existential poets were explaining the conduct of André Sartre, whose philosophies were changing and were leaving the Communist Party, which they once worshipped. And so they were somewhat outspoken. And just as we came abreast of the doorway of the new cabaret, our poor friend, the poet, came flying out, landing in the gutter. And we were told to work with the fellow that the Godfather called 5x5. He says, if you need anything, talk to 5x5. And 5x5, the dimensions of 5x5 was, there's this human block of matter that was 5 feet tall and 5 feet wide, you see. You had to turn sideways to get out of the building, you know, just emanating dreadful physical power. And so we stayed the hell away from the cabaret. Anyway, I was accused of getting them into this mess, you see, but all of them voted that I would go there. Well, in truth, the guy I'll call the Godfather